Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Welcome back. This is Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Israel. We are welcome, Rebbe, for our 26th Shilas conference call. Without further ado, Rebbe, thank you.
Thank you so much. Question number one. Can a chassan and okala attend college classes or go to work during the week of their Sheva Brachos? What guidelines should Rabbanim share with the future couple regarding to their week of Sheva Brachos? One has to look in Shulchan Aruch Evan HaEzer, where there's a discussion of what the ideal of Sheva Brachos is and what can be done in this situation of need of Pidi Evet. Ideally, Sheva Brachos should be a time when, number one, the Chos and Kala spend time together, the Chos is the Sameach, the Kala. Number two, the Chos is Doma LeMelech and should conduct himself in an appropriate fashion. With respect to the first prong, Mechila works. One looks in the Beis Shmuel and Simon Samach Dalet, Os Aleph, sounds that way. Although, there are those who claim that the only time Mechila works is with respect to the first prong, as I mentioned, that he has an obligation to make her happy, the Samcha, that she can be Mochal on. But on his responsibility to be like a Melech, that is an objective requirement, and according to some, the Rama meant to say that Mechila does not work. The Rama didn't say so, he just made a general comment which some interpret that way. In Otzer HaPoskim, Sivkot and Gimel, those bays, they argue and say, no, had the Rama meant to say that, he would have said it explicitly. Don't make too many inferences. Interesting, Rabbi Vadya is in his tshuva. Chelik Dalad, Simon Ches Oz Dalad Yabia Omer. He likes that failure of inference because Rama never really said it. But in any event, Halacha Lemaisa, we should try to be strict unless it's what we call a Dover HaOved. Quotes there from the Minchas Alot, if a person is going to be fired from his job or lose out in some other way, it would be considered a Dover HaOved. And therefore, Dover Ovid is Mutter, even according to those poskim who are resistant to the din of a chosm go to do malacha, and Dover Ovid, they would permit it. And therefore, the bottom line is, he should go to work only if he absolutely has to. And same thing with going to school, only if they absolutely have to. It's called the Dover Ovid. However, above and beyond that, they should spend time together and should not be involved in work or in school. Question two. A couple with young children has come to see me regarding one of their parents who was addicted to smoking. They have asked the parent not to smoke in or around their home, but the parent continues to smoke. They are concerned for kibud avim and their children's health and chinuch. What are their options? Can they go as far as to tell their parents that they are not welcome in their home if they smoke in the house? Now, the Chazon Ish says in Yoredeya, Siman Kuf Mem Tes, that Kibud Av Va'Em only applies when a parent makes a reasonable request of the child. If the request is not a reasonable one, there's no need for the child to obey the request. Therefore, the question will be, fundamentally, the parent wants to smoke in the house. Is that a reasonable request, or is it not a reasonable request? This may depend, to some extent, on the society in which the child and the parents are involved. In some parts of the world, this is, you know, people are smoking all the time, even to this day, even after the Surgeon General said it's unhealthy. That's the stark reality. In other parts of the world, it's not so. The Lashon of the Chazon Ish, Yoredeya Siman Kuf Mem Tes is called Nches. Ha'av tzorach levatel ritzono mipnei ritzon beno, ve'ein ha'bein chaya b'kibudzeh. Which means that if the father is making an unreasonable request, the father should not make the request, and therefore the son has no obligation to honor the request. It seems to me that in many parts of our world, this is an unreasonable request. to expect to come into someone's house and to be able to smoke in the house. These days, it's not acceptable. In public places, it's not acceptable. Certainly shouldn't be acceptable in a private house if the person of the house doesn't want it. If they're visiting the parents' house and the son says, I don't want you to smoke in this house, and his father says, it's my house, so then that's a different story. Maybe the son doesn't have to bring his kids there, he may have to order either himself, but at least he's within his own house. He's coming to someone else's house, even his own child, and he wants to impose his addiction to smoking on someone else's property. Where I come from, that's an unreasonable request. If it's an unreasonable request, the child is not obligated to honor it, and therefore he should say, please don't smoke. Please don't smoke. And he simply refuses to honor the son's question. He's requesting that he shouldn't smoke. You're not required to let him into the house. And if it sounds a sad thing to say, but that's the halacha. If they can somehow work something out, it would be a compromise. If he asked the parent not to smoke in or around the home, they didn't compromise. Don't smoke in the home. Don't smoke around the home. So even though the children are seeing it and it's bad chinuch for them, well, at least it's around the home. It's not in the home. It's not as toxic. And the fact that they're not doing it in the house indicates something as well. Again, we always try to make a compromise. But they come into the house and smoke in the house, which is demonstrated to be dangerous, especially for children, and even for adults. It seems to me that they're not required to honor the parents' request, and they're even allowed to say that you're not welcome if you're going to smoke and endanger my children, endanger me, and set a bad example. Question 3. Can a stepson who feels close to his stepfather sit shiva for him, tear kriya, say kaddish for 11 months? There were other birth sons to say the kaddish. The answer is yes, yes, and yes. Shiva is not really a shiva, because there's no blood relationship, but there's nothing wrong with the person sitting shiva, except for the fact that whatever is a mitzvah, you have to perform. In other words, a person shouldn't say, I'm not going to learn Torah this week because I'm an avelis. You're not really an avelis. So you want to not go to work and sit in a low chair and go with a ripped garment. It's not considered to be about tashchis to rip a garment, because in theory we should rip garments when anybody passes away. We just don't do it typically. But if the person feels that the stepfather was so good to him and he owes such a great debt to him, then it would be permissible. It might even be some kind of a din which relates to like a Rebbe. A parent who brings up a child is like a Rebbe. Some of you may have seen that when Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, passed away last week, many of his Talmidim ripped Kriya because they felt he was their Rebbe in the strongest possible way. And so too, a stepfather for someone who was brought up by him, it's permissible, or not required, to tear kriya. It's permissible to say kaddish for 11 months, and it's permissible to sit shiva, except you shouldn't have bittul Torah. So too, with respect to saying kaddish, if it's a situation where it's you or someone else, so the someone else who's lost a natural parent has kedima as priority, so too with respect to davening for the yamid, but if it doesn't take away from anybody else, there's nothing wrong with saying kaddish. Question 4. Can someone make a chasna this year on Monday, July 27th? The chuppah will take place while still day. Being that Tisha B'Av is a nidcha. The answer is yes. The truth is, even with respect to a nidcha, the 10th of Av is only a problem, according to most poskim, until Chatzos. Look on the Ramah, Simon Tov Kuf Nun Ches Sif Aleph. Although, there may be those who disagree. Look on the Shulchan Aruch and the Shari Tshuva. But in our case, where it's a nidcha, it would certainly be permissible. Question 5. Many Stavon in my shul has finally given a get to his wife after 6 years. Would like to return to Davin and Ashu. Some of my Balabatan have whispered in my ear that this may not be a wise move to welcome him and give him an aliyah, since there are those who feel strongly that he behaved inappropriately, hurt his wife and children, and that, quote, he didn't do tshuva. He only did what he was should have done in the first place, end quote. How should I handle this? Should my concern for my parnasa, future in Rabbonus, my wife's having to deal with the fallout, be a factor? The last part of the question indicates to me that the people who have influence whispered in his ear that if man is let back in and gets an aliyah, that they may fire him. That's certainly inappropriate for Balabatim to say or even imply. And I think the wife has to deal with the fallout means if he's fired. Again, it's certainly not fair. But let's set that aside for a moment and discuss what should it then be objectively. It seems to me, objectively speaking, the person should be accepted, should be given an aliyah. If you don't accept him and you don't give him an aliyah, in my view, you might be causing further exacerbation of the aguna problem. A guy will figure, look, for 6 years I was persona non grata. Now I gave the get as they asked me to, and I'm still persona non grata. So the next guy will say, why should I give the get? I'm going to be persona non grata anyway. I might as well be so without giving a get. Of course, there's another way to see it, the other way, exactly the other way around. If the person will see persona non grata forever, so give the get immediately. I don't know if that's really going to be the case. We'll find a different shul. The closest I can come is something which happened in my shul. It wasn't 6 years, it was 6 months. But something similar happened. And as soon as the get was given and the person came back to my shul, I told the gabbai the first Shabbos he's back, please give him shlishi. So the gabbai asked me, Rabbi, for 6 months he's persona non grata and now I want to give him shlishi? I said, absolutely. It was only persona non grata because he didn't give a get as he was supposed to. That's the only reason. Now he gave the get. He deserves to be welcomed back and deserves to get shlishi. That was my response. Of course, no two situations are identical. There may be other calculations and considerations of which I'm not aware. I hope that the decision will be the correct decision and that the rabbi's parnasa will be assured. Next question, number six. The controversy or non-controversy of the so-called Shabbos switch. I assume you mean what they call today the kosher switch. And you can't call it a non-controversy because it's a tremendous controversy. You may consider one opinion to be right and another opinion to be wrong and view that as a non-controversy. That's for that you don't need any questions and answers. We can spend easily an hour or more on this topic. I'm not going to spend that much time. Just a little bit of background. Many years ago, Rabbi Halperin of Yerushalayim, of Levi Yitzchak Halperin, made some kind of a grammar switch, as he called it, which is based upon something called Minia Samonea. That is something which is preventing light from going on. And you prevent that, you prevent the preventer, you remove the preventer, things of this nature. And he allowed it and only for medical situations or security situations, not as a general rule. And that's exactly why he called it a grama switch, even though he felt fundamentally it was more lenient than regular grama for various reasons. It was only, again, removing or a monea, preventing a preventer, things of this nature. And therefore, he called it a grama switch just so that people should not use it in non-excision situations. No one is sick and there's no security problems. Because he was afraid that if people will use it broadly, they'll mix up one switch with another switch, it'll lead to massive Chilul Shabbos, and he didn't want that at all. More recently, a man developed something called a kosher switch, in which he said there are many enhancements which make his kosher switch better than Rabbi Halperin's grama switch. And therefore, it should be permissible even in non-excision situations. Notwithstanding, the 11 enhancements that he listed off in an article written already more than 5 years ago, in Cheshvan Tovshin Ayin, it's 5.5 years ago, notwithstanding those 11 enhancements, one can readily argue that the fundamental issue was the same. And the 11 changes don't really make that much of a substantive difference. That's my general view. There is an additional consideration, which is known as grumma, the actual grumma. And there are two questions. One, is this grumma better than grumma or worse than grumma? Again, Rav Hoffman thought it's better than grumma. Many, many think it's like grumma. And Rav Shechta Shlita, in an article in Vikri Atzon, Simon Zion, and he's expressed it in this context as well, basically on the opinion of the Rav, thought this is worse than grumma. What is in fact the din of grumma? So for Ashkenazim, grumma also should be disallowed, because the unless b'makom hefsid, that's the psak of the Ramon, Simon Shin Lamedal Sifchav Beis, Yontif may be an exception, perhaps. Are there more lenient views? Absolutely. We usually follow the Rav. And therefore, at least for Ashkenazim, we should not be using this switch on the basis of grumma. Perhaps Sfaradim have a different psak. They have to ask their own Sfaradi poskim. So that's as far as Menia Samanea and as far as grumma is concerned. There are, of course, a number of other considerations. One is the Ramban in next week's Parsha, in Parsha's Emor, where the Ramban says that even if you avoid the technicalities of any of the Lamatas Malachas, the word Shabboson teaches us that we're supposed to try to avoid other activities as well. This could be applied to a Shabbos kosher switch, which could activate anything with enough technology, and the whole spirit of Shabbos would likely be lost. And fourth and final, and perhaps most important, people are not going to distinguish between one switch and another, and it could lead to a massive Chilul Shabbos. I should hasten to add that we spoke before, whether this is grumma or better than grumma or worse than grumma, I didn't fully explain why it could be worse than grumma. The case of grumma in the Gemara is where the fire is burning and you encircle the fire with barrels, and when the fire gets to the barrels, the water will come out of the barrels and put out the fire. In that case, giving the number of perfection of the various Rishonim, number one, it's not sure that the barrels will actually break. Number two, the Shulta Gibram said it's only a psik resha. You don't want to put the fire out. You want to just contain the fire. Number three, in that case, the fire moves, if you will, to the barrels that you place there. In our case, it's perhaps more comparable to a situation in which what you're doing leads the fire, which is the electric pulses, to the receptor, and therefore to put the fire on. It's not a good comparison to the case of grumma. And then there were those who claim that any type of activity which becomes a regular activity would, by definition, be called a Malechus Machsheves and be prohibited on Shabbos, even if otherwise it'd be called grumma, based on Baba Kamad of Samach and Aleph. Therefore, there are many, many reasons to consider this to be even worse than grumma, to be a real Malechus Machsheves is a possibility of Nisa D'Oraisa, and therefore I think it's not advisable. Now, is there a possibility that it's only the Rabbana? Yes. Maybe you should say, because it is called grumma, maybe this idea of Menia Samonea, I'm not excluding those possibilities. But since we cannot rule out the more strict possibilities, Halacha Lamaisa, this switch, I believe, should not be used if it will, in fact, receive the endorsement of Gedolei Yisrael unambiguously and clearly, that can be used in all situations. That we'll have to, you know, think about it again. But for the moment, from what I can see, at least within the Ashkenazi community, the poskim are opposed to it. There have been some controversial endorsements, and the question, what do they endorse? Was it only for emergency use or for any use? that's a different topic. Question number 7. Is there any issue with a Kohen working or volunteering as an EMT or a paramedic? We said it's permissible. Obviously, if somebody passes away, you have to leave the room. Question 8. Can the Rav give some guidelines in regard to when the DNR or DNI order is permitted according to halacha? I once had a story in my shul where two Yiddish-speaking people in the back row were talking as I was walking in at 8:30 on Shabbos morning. And one says to the other, Avrum, Yichob Gechasmet Adiyanar. I overheard it, and I changed my speech. And I said, if anyone has a DNR, rip it up. Because DNR, unfortunately, in the world in which we live, really means DNT, do not treat. It's been written up in the Wall Street Journal, among other recent publications. A DNR is a disaster because people in the hospital will not go out of their way to save your life. Therefore, the only time DNR or DNI is even to be considered is in the case of a terminal patient. And even there, we should be so careful that it shouldn't evolve into a DNT. And it's very, very tricky. Depends on, of course, on the hospital and the doctors, how, if there's someone from the family there at all times. There are many considerations before such a form is signed. There can be cases in which you want it to be signed, but you don't want to tell anybody about it. You want it to be signed because down the road it will be relevant, but you don't want to give it to the nursing staff now, or put it in the patient's record, because they may, again, do DNT instead of DNR. The solution to that is have the patient fill it out and just don't file it. Have it, you know, with you. Make copies so that if there's an emergency situation and the DNI or is in fact appropriate, and there are terminal cases when it's extremely appropriate. The person is unfortunately cannot live much longer. And if you don't, in some places, if you don't sign the DNR, they'll do resuscitation, crack the patient's ribs. The patient's going to die anyway. It's an indignity. It's very, very not right to do. So if this same person had signed the DNR a week before, a month before, it wasn't given to the staff as of yet. When the right time comes, you pull it out and show it to the staff. Obviously, the downside with that is that this terminal situation may arise suddenly before the form is given to the staff and they intubate or resuscitate inappropriately. That's always a downside. I give only one personal example. My mother, Aleha Shalom, was the end of her life. So the doctor, who was a firm oncologist, said that told my father, should sign a DNR. Said that unfortunately the progression of the illness is in its last stages and there's not much life left to go. Told my father to sign the DNR. This was on a Monday night. And not that much more than 24 hours later, my mother, Aleha Shalom, passed away. And when she did, they did not crack her ribs. They didn't perform any resuscitation. It would have been totally futile and inappropriate. So again, as a general rule, it should not be signed. In the case of a terminal patient, it should be signed. But in certain circumstances, it should be signed and not given to the staff. Not put in the patient's chart until a bit later, again, as the case may be. Question number 9. Can you give guidelines as to when a patient can refuse invasive procedures that may be painful or that the patient may not want for other reasons but may prolong the patient's life, even if ultimately will not cure the patient from the disease? There are two tshuvas in the Igros Moshe, M'chosh and Mishpat Chelek Beis, Simon Ayin Gimel and Ayin Dalet. Ayin Gimel, it's Os Hey. Ayin Dalet, it's Os Gimel. There it says a patient may refuse treatments if by the treatments taking place it's going to prolong a life of suffering. especially if the invasive procedure itself can cause pain, and even more so, of course, if the procedure carries a chance of danger to life. That's that situation. Other reasons don't rise to that level. The patient should not refuse treatment. If he did anyway, we tried to convince him to accept the treatment and he refused. We should not force him by force, literally, to have this treatment done. Rav Moshe writes, number one, the mere fact that he's resisting and you force it upon him can cause a danger to him through psychological trauma, etc. And number two, that may even lead to a physical danger if he doesn't want the treatment that's sort of forced upon him. So therefore, the answer is, Rav Moshe believes in patient autonomy up to a point has to be a logical decision. What's the logical decision? Any life I'm going to lead from now on is going to be racked with pain, and I'm not going to be able to do what I've been doing until now, and it'll be traumatic to me, and I can't survive anyway. It's just a matter of time, now or later. I'm not interested in leading extra years on a machine in pain and in dignity. That's not an irrational decision and should be honored, Rav Moshe writes. But if it's an irrational decision, I don't want treatment. Why not? Because I'm just not interested. Whatever Hashem wants, he wants, and not going to be treated. That's not rational at all. Then you have to work very hard that the patient should accept treatments, should not allow him to not do the treatments. If he absolutely refuses, you just keep trying harder. But to do it against his wishes would be certainly problematic. Perhaps if he's not conscious right now, then it can be done against his wishes, because then he's not going to resist it physically, and perhaps psychologically it would not be as harmful to him if he wakes up and finds this thing there already. Obviously, every single case has its own wrinkles. Question number 10. It seems the custom is to tear kriya for a relative either at the levaya or at the cemetery. Why do we not make the bracha of Dionymus and tear kriya upon hearing the news of the death? That's an excellent question, and strictly speaking, the questioner is correct. However, our minhag is not to do it that way for a variety of reasons. One, the people who can't do kriya, physically, you don't have the strength to get through the garment. The garments are hemmed. You just can't get through with just rip with your own strength. What usually happens at a levaya or a kvura is that they take a razor and they go through the outside hem, and then the person rips the rest of the way himself or herself. People often don't have razors or other implements at the time of the patira. That's a simple matter of fact. Number two, even if a person has a razor there, many people don't know how to rip kriya. They rip from the middle of the garment instead of ripping from the edge. They rip too small an amount, less than the size of a tefach. In a situation of a pair, they should do achigalas libo. And the question, of course, again, which garment should be torn? A lot of halachas that the average individual who's never experienced this in his life, or even if he has once, doesn't know how to do it. And therefore, the minig, as was correctly pointed out, emerged that it's not done until the levaya or the cemetery, but presumably at that point in time, there's a rabbi there, there's a chevra kadisha there, and they're able to do it then. And frankly, that's the minute which I followed with my parents, Aleha Mashalom. I did not rip the kriya until later. And I believe that's the proper hanhaga, given that in most cases, it really has to be done that way. Mishum lo plug, I think it's easier if it's done that way in all situations. Okay. Question number 11. Very sad question. The day of the Leviah of the seven Neshamas lost in a fire, that was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, I was invited to attend Achnas Sefer Torah in a neighboring community. Although I did not personally attend out of a sense of loss and my personal sensitivity to the tragedy, the rabbi hosting the event felt should not be postponed, and the simcha did go on with music and dancing. What would the right response be? Should the event have been canceled to show Klal Yisrael that it's not a time for simcha to convey Gam Anachnu Imachem Etzara? Or perhaps no, we should not cancel and attend such an important simcha to convey Klal Yisrael goes on despite tragedy. In addition, in general, if a community rabbi feels it should go on in his shul, and I'm invited as a community rabbi to attend, I don't feel it should go on, should I still attend as the son of Kavod Rabbanus and to say Aklus within the community or not? Excellent questions. There's no one answer to this question. Depends upon the judgment of the local Rav and knowledge of his own community as to which is better. I remember, although it's far from identical, when we mentioned before the Igros Moshe, where Moshe Feinstein Zecher Tzadik Livracha was Nifter, it was Tainus Esther. And that night, the night after the Levaya, was Purim night. And it was a tremendous question. Rav Moshe wasn't even buried yet. The plane was even Eretz Yisrael that night. And should the annual Purim Chagiga with the music, with the dancing, with the spiels, with the whole thing go on or not? My recollection is that in our yeshiva, the Chagiga was canceled. Whereas in more yeshivas, the Chagiga went on, which is, you might think, counterintuitive, given the particular circumstances. No particular decision was right or wrong. People sort of, I guess, went with their gut. You would have said, on Purim, it's an apachu. But in our yeshiva, we did not have, and other yeshivas they did. But perhaps we wanted to teach a lesson that of Imo Anochi Betzara. If Godel Ador passed away, we shouldn't be singing and dancing. And perhaps in other yeshivas, where that was a foregone conclusion, they felt that they should go on with the Chagiga. How that plays out in this particular situation, of course, is a bit complex. It may depend, you know, how far the community of these two rabbis was from the Flatbush community where the tragedy took place. It may depend on the reaction of the Balabatim. It may depend if a Chnos Sefer Torah often is a private simcha as well as a public simcha where a certain individual donated it, and what would the reaction be on the part of that donor if the Chnos Sefer Torah is postponed. These are complicated questions. I don't think there's one correct answer to this question. As far as the second half, the one rabbi and another rabbi, Kavod HaRabbanus is important. Achdus in the community is important. My reaction would be that the rabbi who felt it should be canceled should go anyway as a demonstration of community achdus, since the rabbi who said it should go on has a basis. Unless he feels that it would he feels so strongly that he can't bring himself to go, so then he can't go. People miss community events for 100 other reasons, happy or sad. So I think that if he decided not to go, he should not publicize that Rabbi X is wrong, I'm Rabbi Y, I'm holier than thou, I have Imo Anochi, but sorry, he doesn't. That would be a terrible message to convey. If he can't come, he just should disappear. No one should know where he is. And they asked, well, he had a conflict. They'll think the conflict means a bar mitzvah, a wedding, and the conflict was he felt he couldn't go. This is if he feels he cannot go. Question number 12. The Erev in town was examined on Friday morning and found to be intact. An announcement was placed on the Erev hot bar that people can carry on Shabbat. An hour before candle lighting, a break is found in the Erev. What is the policy? Half hour, 15 minutes, 5 minutes. I'm aware that if an individual discovers a break on Shabbat, the person who keeps quiet does not rely upon the Eruv, but what about before candle lighting? This is a complicated story. It is true, if you look at the Shemir Shabbos Kilchasa, the Perik Yuzayin, Sif Chaf Hei in the old edition, Sif Lama Dalad and footnote Kuf Lama Tes in the new edition, They say there are two reasons why a person should be quiet. One, mutav shu shogegin. People aren't going to listen if you tell them that not to carry. They already have stuff with them, etc. Just let them do it b'shogeg rather than b'mezid. Second, more lumdish reason is, it's called a misasek. He doesn't know what he's doing. He thinks he's carrying in a area surrounded by mechitzis. He's wrong. He doesn't know. The Gemara in Shabbat of Ayin Gimel and Manav talks about that. He thinks he's throwing into Rishus HaYachid, ends up throwing into Rishus HaRabim. Perhaps it's called a misasek, especially since we are assuming that the Easter tiltel without an air is midirabonah. Not going into the lumdus now, but those who rely upon a Surah HaPesach, a wire which goes down, are generally assuming that even without that wire, if you carried, it would only be an Easter Dirabonah. Almost everybody assumes that way. But if it had been a Din Daraisa, what we call Osti Rabbim Mavat Lemechitza, then even the wire wouldn't help. It's for a longer discussion. There's a beautiful sefer called Nesiva Shabbos, or a Bloy from Yerushalayim, quotes many, many Gedolim of Yerushalayim over the years, that they said the same two arguments, with the Shushogun, especially as soon as it's the Rabbanon, and also Misasek. Difference would be, what if you know for a fact he's going to listen to you? If it's Misasek, you don't have to tell him. If it's not called Misasek, then you should tell him, because he's going to listen. An interesting source is an article by Rabbi Ezra Schwartz some 10 years ago in the Journal of Halach Contemporary Society. Quotes Mishnah Ravan, Ravan Kotler Zatzal, or Rechaim Simon Dalin Ozvov, based on the Sugya and Mesechta Menachos, Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Beis, and the Shubas Rabbi Kiveger, Simon Ches, and Lecha Mishnah, Perik Aleph and Nechel Shabbos Halacha Ches, where there seem to be some pushback, and they seem to be Gedolim who suggest that this kind of a Misasek is what we call in our language a Maisa Aveira. Obviously he doesn't know about it, it's not really his quote-unquote fault, the Erev fell down. How's he supposed to know? The message said it was up. But nonetheless, looking at it, if you look at it retrospectively, we're not going to say it's not a Maisa Aveira at all, but rather it is a Maisa Aveira and requires a Kapara. That being the case, as Rabbi Kivega argues, at least in some cases, it would be appropriate to tell a fellow, if he's going to listen to you, that he should not be carrying. If the other view was correct, that's the view of the Mekseva Mekor Chaim, by the Nesivis, the beginning of Hilchos Pesach, and many Gedolim subscribe to that view, that Misasek is not a Maisa Aveira at all, then it's more reason not to tell him in this situation. That's all if it felt broke on Shabbos. If it breaks just before Shabbos, it all depends on the circumstances. Clearly, if a notice can go out before Shabbos, the people will be able to avoid putting themselves in difficult situations with babies and all kinds of keys and things which they would have compensated for had they known in advance. Obviously, if the air is down on Friday morning, you do make an announcement. You don't say Mutav Shu Shog, you don't say Misasek, because people have a possibility of adjusting themselves in time. Look, we lived without air for many years. So you talk about an hour, half an hour, 15 minutes, 5 minutes. It all depends if the word can get out in time somehow or other. Often people have all kinds of devices, but they turn them off before candle lighting. So they'll get the email on Motzei Shabbos. That's not going to help any. Sometimes there are sound bites. The phone can pick it up. That might work even 5 minutes before candle lighting. And then the people can take the proper precautions not to be caught in a compromised situation when there's no Erev. Then I think it should be put out, the notice. But if it cannot be, whether it's on Shabbos or just before Shabbos, then, again, according to those who say it should be quiet, if it breaks on Shabbos, it should be quiet just before Shabbos as well. Question 13. What are the criteria that make an electric shaver kosher or non-kosher? There's a major dispute. On a simple level, if the razor touches the skin, it's not kosher, like a regular razor. And if it doesn't touch the skin, then it is kosher. you'll ask, well, what happens in our shavas? Does it or does it not? So some of these advertisements, lift and cut, things of this nature, convey an impression that the razor actually touches the skin. I have two letters in my file from the company, I think it's Norelco company, that say that's not true, that the razor does not touch the skin, despite the advertising, and as a result, it should be presumably permissible. There's an article in Tchumen, Volume Chav Beis, the Rabbi Yisrael Rosen, who I know from my days in Karen B'Yavna years ago, who's a Talmud Chacham, but also a man of realia. He actually went, I have it correctly, to Holland, where the Philips manufacturing plant is, and he spoke to the people there and had videos and pictures, etc. My understanding of this article, it's a little complex, is that in point of fact, indeed, the razor does not touch the skin. There's a slight separation between the skin and the razor, and therefore, one can argue that it's what's called misparayim kein tar, it's not a razor, and should be, in fact, permissible. He discusses it's microscopic and this and that. And there are those who have a different criteria, and they say that if the blade is sharp enough to cut on its own, then it's a problem. If it only cuts together with the screen, then it's not a problem. Rav Rosen's conclusion in that one was that they're just about all capable of cutting the hair, even without the screen. And therefore, if you follow that criterion, they're all going to be prohibited. So too, if a small separation between the razor and the skin is insufficient, they're probably all going to be prohibited. However, if you accept the more lenient position, namely that even a small separation from the skin suffices, and if you assume, as we said earlier, that this is considered to be a misparayim ke'ein tar, notwithstanding the fact that the blade is sharp enough to cut on its own, since it doesn't touch the skin, then they're all permissible. So I know that there's a whole industry of what's kosher, what's not kosher. If I read correctly, the upshot of Rabbi Rosen is they're either all kosher or all not kosher, since the custom has been for many years that we are lenient in utilizing some of the electric shaver, the result would be that they're all kosher. But again, if someone has a different opinion, then probably they're all not kosher. Question 14, last one. Our Kiev organization has been working with a 37-year-old fellow for 6 months. We only discovered months after starting to work with him that he's an adopted child. His biological parents are not Jewish. His adoptive parents gave him a milah, and there's a letter he was dipped in the mikveh at age 2 by 3 frum rabbis. We contacted the one surviving rabbi who told us this was done as a favor to the adopted grandparents of the boy, who were European survivors, and wanted a frum geirus. However, the boy was never raised as a frum boy. He was not given a Jewish education. When he was in college in Cincinnati, he has read a lot about Judaism, and now keeps kosher on some level, puts on tefillin. He was really moving forward nicely with us, taking on Shabbos observance and even davening with the shul on weekdays. But when we discovered his background and told him he needs to do a real geirus, he stopped coming to our shul. And as said, based on his research, he believes it is a chumrah to convert and does not want to do that. I have a weekly chavrusa with him for months, assuming he most likely will not want to convert. But there is a slight possibility that he might. Is it permitted for me to learn Torah with him? An excellent question. Excellent question. My understanding is that assuming his parents are completely not from, Gemara says in Masechta Ksuba Tafir Aleph from an Aleph, Kerkot Matbil Noswal Das Bezen, why? Zochen Lodom Shalom Befonov. There are many poskim who maintain it's not as chus to be a non-observant Jew, better be an observant non-Jew and keep 7 mitzvahs. However, this is not universally accepted. And the two greatest poskim of recent times, I believe both ruled, there's a suffix that we're not sure. Is it a schus to be a non-observant Jew over an observant non-Jew or not? These two Gdolim are Rav Moshe, as they written Shuvah here in Igros Moshe. I believe Rav Yoshev. It's exactly the same thing. It's a suffix. That's why I'm personally opposed to doing such garrison in the first place, because we don't want to make suffix. But if it was done, I believe it rises to the level of suffix. What about a suffix? What do you do with a suffix? So, ideally, we try to resolve the suffix. The only way to resolve the suffix is if he undergoes an additional garris and he's completely firm. But that is something we would want to pursue. We normally don't run after garrison. We even push them away. But if it's a suffix gair already, then it makes sense to try to do a garris which will certainly be good, because otherwise you're left in an eternal situation of suffix. Rav Moshe has even a bigger chiddush, that if it's going to be done in a conservative way and people are going to get married anyway, it may still be better for a person who's firm to do it. But that's not this present discussion. Therefore, the bottom line is, he's a suffix Yisrael. He may agree later on to convert. I believe not only is it permissible to learn with him, I think it's a mitzvah to learn with him. Hopefully this mitzvah will bring him close. The Torah will bring him close to realize that for his own good, even if he considers it to be a chumrah, the geirus should still be done. We would, in our bezin, we would not make a brach on such a geirus because of the possibility that the first geirus was valid. And if you tell them in that fashion, yes, you're right, we're not saying you're not Jewish. Of course, you may have been Jewish. And the proof is you're not going to make a bracha. But since there is a possibility that this situation is not that of a ger, maybe you're not a ger, and maybe down the road people are going to question your gerus, so why don't you just undergo a gerus l'chumra if he's totally from? That's what should be done. But in the interim, until you can convince him, I believe it's permissible to learn Torah with him under these circumstances. This completes the final question.
Rebbe, thank you very much. We hope, Bezrat Hashem, we can call on you in the future when the next set of Shalas come in. Thank you. Have a good day, everyone. Take care.